That's absolutely critical. And it's, and you know, Sudan is a good example. It was led by young people. It was led by women, very courageous women. It was led by those who just had enough of it.
Yeah, where are they now when it comes to the formal negotiations?
Well, there are no formal negotiations. I mean, to be honest, not very serious ones at the moment. I don't think these two guys are serious about it. They think that they can win on the battlefield and they will bring the country to the brink. Well, it's already close to the brink, so I don't know how deeper it can go. Huh?
And the role of the media?
Well, of course it is. Well, if you look, I'll just give you one example. If you look it is so crucial that we have independent, serious media that report on these situations and that they bring them to the table of everywhere in the world. If I look at even mainstream media today, I'm very disappointed. I mean, just to give, and I know it's a sensitive thing to raise, but just look at what happened. We had within a week the sinking of the boat in Greece and then the submarine with the Titanic. Just watch how much attention was paid to the submarine. I think it was almost minute by minute. And the probably 800 people that died horribly, it was maybe a day, maybe another news sometime else. And if that had happened, if it had been a plane, if it had been, this would be what, four planes crashing? Can you imagine what this would have meant? So there is an interesting dimension to how media report about what I think is very selective.
At Democracy Now, we called it the Titanic disparity.
That's how you called it?
Yes.
Exactly. I'm glad you think about that, yes.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up, and this has been a fascinating discussion. Are there any final words you'd like to offer?
Well, we will have a continuation of our discussions tomorrow, but I think one thing that for me is so important that we, and I sometimes feel it with politicians these days, they forget about history or they don't really want to know much about history. I don't know whether, Margaret, it was also your experience, especially some of the younger generations. History is sort of put somewhere else. Sometimes it's not even known. And we really need to know about it. And we need to know what the genesis is of the type of achievements that we have had, also on the human rights side. And we should be so grateful for what the human rights movement has achieved over the last 100 years, because actually even in the 19th century with the labor movement. I mean, you have so many different movements, decolonization. I mean, you have all these movements. Well, it starts with some of the revolutions. And that actually gives me a lot of hope that the big issues of our time and of the future, we are able to do it again through the human rights lens, because it brings us back to what unites us. It brings us back to what is a solution. It's not just the doom and gloom. It is a solution to problems. And and we just need to find, well, new era, right? We have to think about human rights for the new era, but it is human rights.
That's Volker Türk, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Eamon Gilmore, the European Union Special Representative for Human Rights, and Margot Wallström, the former Swedish foreign minister. She was also the former deputy prime minister of Sweden and the former head of Sweden's Social Democratic Party, as well as the former UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict. They were speaking this weekend at a conference I moderated in Venice, Italy, talking about a new era for human rights, the conference organized by the Global Campus of Human Rights and Right Livelihood to mark the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As the conference ended, thousands of Venetians went out in boats. We joined them to celebrate the city's oldest holiday, marking the end of the 16th century plague, the pestilence that killed a third of Venice's population. There was a half-hour fireworks display as people celebrated. I'm Amy Goodman, back in New York. Thanks for joining us.
my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, civil rights attorney Michael Avery discusses the role the Federalist Society played in the Supreme Court's recent decision gutting affirmative action.
The Supreme Court struck down race-based affirmative action programs in colleges and universities.
And our own Marjorie Cohn discusses the Supreme Court's recent case, Moore versus Harper, that shut down a fringe legal theory on voting rights.
The Supreme Court maintained the status quo in the face of Republican attacks on the right to vote.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. On June 28th, the Supreme Court made front page national headlines for overturning legal precedent supporting race-based affirmative action programs in colleges and universities. The decision rejected race-conscious admissions at Harvard College and the University of North Carolina, or UNC. The court's conservative supermajority found in favor of Students for Fair Admissions, a nonprofit founded in 2014 that sued Harvard and UNC over their admissions procedures. The group, headed by conservative activist Edward Blum, alleged that the process violates Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by discriminating against Asian American applicants in favor of white applicants. Paving the way for overturning 40 years of precedent was one group that we've covered for years on Law and Disorder, the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. This conservative, libertarian organization advocates for a textualist and originalist interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. Over several decades, until recently working under the radar, it has dramatically altered the legal landscape in this country. Joining us today is civil rights attorney Michael Avery, co-author with Danielle McLaughlin of the 2013 book, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, and a recent article in Truthout, co-authored with Professor Mark Broden, about how the Federalist Society killed affirmative action. Professor Emeritus at Suffolk University Law School, Michael Avery was president of the National Lawyers Guild and served as president of the board of the National Police Accountability Project. Michael Avery, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Michael, what were the three main rationales that Chief Justice John Roberts outlined in his decision for the Supreme Court on affirmative action?
First of all, Roberts found that the goals of diversity in education were not clear enough or coherent enough to allow progress toward them to be measured. Now, the court had previously found that these goals were an appropriate reason for using race-conscious methods in selecting students, but suddenly they deemed that they were not. Second, he said that Harvard and UNC were using their affirmative action plans as a negative against non-minority students. That's an odd thing for him to stress because, of course, admission to college is a zero-sum game. If more black students get in, fewer white students will get in, and vice versa. So that was, you know, something that I found out in the opinion. And he also said that the plans allowed for the stereotyping of black students. And apparently that was based on the argument that the schools made that black students bring something different to the classroom than white students do. You know, you can accept that proposition without immediately assuming that the person making it means that all black students bring the same thing. To be honest with you, I didn't find that persuasive either. And then the third point he made was that the affirmative action plans lacked a logical endpoint. In 2003, when the Supreme Court decided the Grutter case, saying that diversity was the legitimate goal of affirmative action plans, Justice O'Connor had hypothesized that in 25 years, such plans would no longer be necessary. It was a completely arbitrary figure at the time, and interestingly enough, was never tied to how much progress, black people and other minorities were actually making in American society.
Michael, why do you think we still need race-conscious decision-making?
Well, I think the purpose of race-conscious decision-making ought to be to overcome social discrimination, which has left black people and other minorities at considerable disadvantage in almost every aspect of life in America. Now, the Supreme Court has rejected that as a justification for race-conscious decision-making, and really, over the years, kind of painted civil rights proponents into a corner where the only thing they could rely on was this diversity argument. Many of us never felt that diversity was the appropriate rationale for race-conscious decision-making in the first place. And in this case, both Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson stressed in their decisions that black people and other minorities are still at considerable disadvantage as a result of social discrimination. And their opinions really advocate that should be the rationale for race-conscious decision-making by the government.
Well, the 6-3 majority and Sotomayor, Jackson, and Kagan were, of course, in the dissent. But the majority did, however, uphold affirmative action in the military and for children of alumni, many of whom are white. What did the opinions by the dissenting justices Sotomayor, Jackson, and Kagan say?
You know, the dissenting opinions really describe a very different America than the majority justices like to pretend they're living in. And they described the many disadvantages that black people and other minorities have in American society and argued that it would be appropriate to use race-conscious means in order to overcome that kind of discrimination. The minority opinions give you a real feel for the history and for the present situation of black people in America and talk in real terms about what would be necessary to overcome that.
Michael, the Federalist Society has always wanted to end affirmative action. Can you give us a nutshell version of their efforts and how they led up to this decision, beginning with the Reagan administration?
Well, in the Reagan administration, Edwin Meese, who was Ronald Reagan's attorney general and before that counselor to the president, came with him from California when Reagan came to the White House, immediately recognized that these young Federalist Society law students who started the organization in the early 80s could be of great help to conservatives in the administration. And so they got jobs in the Justice Department, clerking for various judges, and in the White House. They began to develop policy across many fronts, not just affirmative action, of course, but across many fronts. And then the lawyers who were working in the Justice Department, lawyers like William Bradford Reynolds, Samuel Alito, who was then in the Justice Department, and other Roberts, now Chief Justice John Roberts, was in the Justice Department during the Reagan years. These lawyers began to turn federal policy around, turn it away from the direction it was headed in the Johnson administration with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. The person who's now Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court was then made head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and turned that around, away from systemic change, away from looking at the kind of measures that companies had adopted to make it difficult for blacks to get jobs and black workers to get jobs, and only focused on individual cases of black people who'd suffered discrimination. So that in a number of very important Supreme Court cases, which we describe in our article, Professor Mark Brodin and I, the government actually changed sides. Instead of promoting the relief that workers wanted, black workers wanted, began taking the side of the white workers and arguing against the reforms that federal judges all over the country were coming up with. By 1986, the federal government had in effect switched sides when it came to civil rights for American workers.
Well, by his own admission, Clarence Thomas was a beneficiary of affirmative action in his admission to Holy Cross College and Yale Law School, and yet he wants to slam the door behind him. Could you tell us about his views on affirmative action, please?
Yes. Justice Thomas wrote a concurring opinion in this case that the court just decided. And he has many arguments. I'll just try to focus on a few of the most important ones. Justice Thomas believes in the colorblind Constitution, and that's a point of view that's very popular in the Federalist Society, even though American society is not colorblind. And, of course, Justices Jackson and Sotomayor stress this in their dissenting opinions. Even though American society is not colorblind, he wants to read the words of the 14th Amendment, the words that, of course, we all are proud of about equality. He wants to read them as though they can be exported into society in literal terms without taking into account what's actually happening in society. And so in his opinion, he tries to come up with an originalist theory. You know, that's the Federalist Society's preferred mode of constitutional interpretation, an originalist theory that the Constitution and the 14th Amendment were meant to be colorblind and should be interpreted as colorblind. The alternative theory is that the 14th Amendment, when it speaks about equality, it's really speaking more about anti-subordination, that no one group should be able to subordinate another group. If the listeners want to read more about that, I recommend Pamela Carlin, Professor Pamela Carlin's many articles to them, where she lays out that theory very persuasively. In addition to this colorblind idea, Justice Thomas rejects the notion that affirmative action or race-conscious measures can be used to overcome social discrimination. He thinks it's wrong that white students who get denied admission in order to make space for black students, he thinks it's wrong that they're hurt by that. He says they'll resent that. It'll lead to greater racial tension in the future. And then finally, he argues that it's bad for the black students who are admitted to these schools under affirmative action plans. He says that they're underprepared. They won't be able to make it in the elite schools that they get into this way. He argues we should simply have a simple meritocracy, let people make it on the basis of, I guess, their previous experience. And no matter how difficult that may be, You know, all these Federalist Society justices reject what they call racial balancing. They don't think it's appropriate for any given institution, whether it's a company that's hiring workers or a school that's admitting students, to be concerned about what the demographics are of the community in which they find themselves. It's not important to them whether these institutions reflect that community fairly or not. And so they denounce what they call racial balancing and reject notions to have, you know, institutions reflect the communities in which they're found.
Michael, going back for a second to your referencing how the Federalist Society really maneuvered the U.S. government to switch sides, essentially from litigating against discrimination to, in effect, supporting it. Can you talk about the case of Wygant v. Jackson Board of Education?
You know, as the civil rights movement rolled on, employers began to hire black workers. The problem that then arose is that these recently hired black workers would be the first ones laid off when layoffs were necessary because of the seniority system. You know, unions had long argued last hired, first fired. You know, if you didn't have racial problems, maybe that would be fair. But where you have racial problems and the last hired workers tended to be the minority workers, the fact that they were laid off first really retarded the ability of us to make progress with regard to fair hiring. And so some places tried to solve that problem by giving protection against layoffs to recently hired minority workers. School board in Jackson, Michigan tried to do that, and that led to the case that you brought up, Wygant against Jackson Board of Education. And there, the Reagan administration filed a brief supporting the white teachers, arguing for this colorblind constitution. And it ended up that the protection for recently hired black teachers was held to be unconstitutional. That was a major blow to the civil rights movement.
My co-host Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with Professor Emeritus Michael Avery about the Supreme Court's new opinion striking down race-based affirmative action programs in colleges and universities. Michael, please talk about how Federalist Society lawyers push for the most difficult standard required for affirmative action programs to be ruled constitutional. It's called strict scrutiny. Can you tell us the significance of that?
That has been a very significant development in the law. And again, it took place in the 1980s when Reagan Department of Justice lawyers, who happened to be Federalist Society lawyers, and Federalist Society lawyers in private practice, bombarded the Supreme Court with briefs urging the court to adopt this strict scrutiny standard. The strict scrutiny standard says if you're going to use race-conscious methods in hiring or admitting students to school, you have to have a compelling governmental interest that your program is serving. And that compelling governmental interest has to be narrowly tailored. It can't do anything more than the minimum necessary to achieve that governmental interest. And the problem with that is then the court went on to accept almost none of the rationales that had been offered as a compelling governmental interest. In fact, they said really the only ones we're going to recognize is if a particular person was discriminated against in the past by a particular employer or government agency, then they can get relief from race-conscious measures because they're a direct victim. And beyond that, the only rationale they accepted as a compelling government interest was diversity in higher education, not even at the not even at the high school level, but only in higher education. And then now what's happened is that since they pulled the rug out from under diversity as a legitimate justification, there was really nothing left. And that's why this decision is going to have such terrible results, not just in education, but with respect to hiring and other decisions that are made by government. And for that matter, private parties, when we import the government standards into private affairs through legislation like Title VII, Civil Rights Act. So this strict scrutiny has really been the death knell of using race-conscious measures to overcome previous discrimination.
Michael, can you please talk about the strategy the Federalist Society used in the Harvard and UNC cases?
They came with a different kind of client than they had in the past. In the previous cases, with people like Alan Bakke from the Bakke case years ago from the 70s, and then Ms. Fisher from the Fisher case, which is a more recent case, the Federalist Society their lawyers would represent the white students who had been denied admission and argue that those students had been had suffered an injury from the fact that the affirmative action plan was admitting black students or other minority students in their place. That was embarrassing for them in a couple of cases because the courts found that the white students were in fact not even qualified to be admitted in the first place. So this time they had this organization, the Students for Fair Admission, that they were representing. And it's a group that was, this group was started by a man named Ed Bloom, who's an anti-affirmative action guy. Originally they just had 40 members. They started the group just so they would have a group to become a plaintiff in litigation, and then gradually they got a lot more anti-affirmative action people to join the group, and they argued that this group, which represented white students and in particular Asian American students, should be given standing by the court to raise the affirmative action plans at Harvard and at the University of North Carolina. And the courts went along with that and said that the group was allowed to raise the interests of their members. So now they were arguing a much more broad-based kind of claim than they had in the past. And in fact, the brief that the plaintiff's lawyers filed in the case stressed very much the plight of Asian American students. You know, Asian American students and Asian American people have had their own problems in American society, and so they were very sympathetic as plaintiffs in this case. And I think that gave the anti-affirmative action people a more sympathetic argument than they were able to make in the past.
Michael, what will be the impact of the Supreme Court's decision in the Harvard and University of North Carolina cases?
Devastating. In California, after I believe it was Proposition 209 passed, which made affirmative action measures like this illegal in California, the admission rate at some universities for black and other minority students dropped by 50%. The universities are scrambling now to try to find a workaround to allow them to still encourage minority students to apply and to be admitted. But that's going to be very difficult under this decision. Roberts tried to hold out an olive branch, saying that the schools could take into account if a black student came and said that as a result of race, he or she had had specific experiences that influenced them in a particular way, perhaps the school could take that into account. But then in the very next sentence in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, he said the court was not going to allow the schools to get around the decision it was making simply by relying on personal essays from the students. And Justice Sotomayor characterized this effort by Roberts to hold out this olive branch as an attempt to put lipstick on a pig.
Michael, we just have a couple of minutes remaining. What would you recommend be done to overcome the effects of social discrimination?
Well, oh my word. You know, to overcome social discrimination, I think we need a variety of different programs across the board, educational programs, social programs, and we do need government programs that will take race into account to overcome deficiencies that some groups have suffered in the past as a result of discrimination. We are still very bad off in this country. The deck is stacked in favor of whites, in favor of we see the same thing when it comes to discrimination against homosexual or transgender people. We see the same thing when it comes to discrimination against women. We have to face this problem squarely and be honest about what the problem is and then address it with measures that are designed to overcome specific disadvantages that people have suffered in the past. And that is going to require, you know, something akin to a public health campaign to overcome the resentment and anger that many white people or straight people or men are now, you know, showing in political terms. That requires a movement of a social justice movement like the civil rights movement was in the 50s and 60s. And we need to have an organization, whether it's the American Constitution Society or the National Lawyers Guild or somebody else, that can challenge what the Federalist Society is now getting away with in terms of the influence it has on law and public policy in this country.
Well, Michael, we're going to have to leave it there with those very strong words from you. And thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder to explain this very alarming development from the Supreme Court.
Well, Marjorie and Heidi, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me to be on the show.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On June 27, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case that protected voting rights from an obscure theory that could have eliminated the right of state courts to review new voting provisions enacted by state legislatures. In Moore v. Harper, a six-member majority of the High Court rejected the, quote, independent state legislature doctrine. Conservative legislators in North Carolina had sought to maintain an extreme gerrymandered congressional map they'd drawn that favored Republicans. Although Chief Justice John Roberts has a track record of decisions that weakened the right to vote. He wrote the court's opinion in Moore, as well as in Allen v. Milligan on June 8th, both of which strengthen voting rights. With us today to explain the court's decision in Moore v. Harper is our own co-host Marjorie Cohn. She wrote the article titled, Here's What Moore v. Harper Means for Voting Rights Going Forward, that was published by Truthout. Marjorie is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She's also on the advisory boards of Veterans for Peace, Assange Defense, and the American Association of Jurists. She writes frequent articles and provides commentary about legal and political issues. Marjorie's most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing: Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn, welcome to the interview chair on Law and Disorder.
It's great to be with you, Heidi, as usual.
Marjorie, please explain the independent state legislature doctrine. What does the Elections Clause of the U.S. Constitution say?
Well, the fringe theory called independent state legislature would give state legislatures virtually unchecked power to establish discriminatory voting laws and gerrymander congressional districts that favor one political party, with no judicial review by the state Supreme Court. And adopting that doctrine would fly in the face of more than 200 years of U.S. jurisprudence. The independent state legislature theory was at the heart of efforts to nullify the results of the 2020 presidential election. Donald Trump's lawyer, John Eastman, who is facing disbarment proceedings in California, by the way, pushed this fringe theory to facilitate their campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history, in the words of a federal court judge. And then Pennsylvania Republicans unsuccessfully challenged a ruling of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that relied on the state constitution to extend the deadline for absentee ballots. The Elections Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which is found in Article 1, Section 4, says times, places, and manner for holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, unquote. Now, the independent state legislature doctrine interprets the word legislature to mean only the actual legislature. But the Supreme Court has always assumed that legislature includes the rulings of state courts that are interpreting the state's constitution, citizen ballot measures, and governor's vetoes.
Somehow, Marjorie, I missed this in constitutional law in law school. Where did the doctrine originate? And has the U.S. Supreme Court ever adopted it?
After the 2000 presidential election, a right-wing majority of the U.S. Supreme Court halted the counting of Florida ballots on equal protection grounds, and they delivered the presidency to George W. Bush. Now, Chief Justice William Rehnquist wrote a concurrence in that case, Bush v. Gore, that was joined by Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia. And that concurrence suggested that the obscure independent state legislature doctrine should have been used to overrule the Florida Supreme Court's decision allowing the ballot recount because it conflicted with the deadlines established by the Florida legislature. But the U.S. Supreme Court has never embraced the independent state legislature doctrine.
What would be the ramifications if the Supreme Court had adopted this fringe theory?
If the court had adopted the independent state legislature doctrine, hundreds of state constitutional measures that govern federal elections could be nullified. It would make it easier for state legislatures to engage in voter suppression and undermine election results. It would enable the drawing of gerrymandered congressional districts, and state legislators in swing states could reject slates of electors chosen by voters and appoint their own substitutes, as Trump advocated. Now, during the oral argument in this case in December of last year, Elena Kagan noted that the independent state legislature doctrine, quote, is a theory with big consequences. It would permit no state constitutional remedy for the most extreme forms of gerrymandering by legislatures, which could enact all manner of restrictions on voting, get rid of all kinds of voter protections that the state constitution in fact prohibits, unquote. Basically, she said legislatures could insert themselves into the certification of elections.
Marjorie, what were the facts in Moore v. Harper?
Well, GOP legislators in North Carolina petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court in February of last year to restore their extremely gerrymandered congressional map that would have given Republicans as many as 10 of the state's 14-member congressional delegation in the midterm elections. Now, North Carolina is evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, as reflected in the 7-7 seat split between the two parties in the midterms. The North Carolina Supreme Court, which then had a 4-3 Democratic majority, held in February of 2022 that the map was a partisan gerrymander that violated the state constitution's guarantee of free and fair elections, and it refused to allow the map to be used in the 2022 midterm elections. In March, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the state Supreme Court ruling blocking the use of the map while the legal issue was being considered by the federal high court. Meanwhile, after the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to review the case, the North Carolina Supreme Court, which had switched now to a 5-2 GOP majority in the November 22 midterms, reversed its prior ruling and dismissed the challenges to the gerrymandered map, holding that it didn't have the authority to review those challenges. Now, in light of the new decision of the North Carolina Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court could have just refused to hear the case because it was now moot. And that's what Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, and Samuel Alito argued in their dissent. But the majority took on the legal issue, and 6 members of the Supreme Court rejected the independent state legislature doctrine.
Now, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that majority opinion. What did it say?
Well, first, let me say that in the course of explaining why laws are subject to judicial review, that means that courts can review them for constitutionality, Roberts cited the leading case of Marbury versus Madison, which was decided in 1803, quote, proclaiming that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is, unquote. And Heidi, I'm sure you studied Marbury versus Madison in constitutional law.
Yes.
The Elections Clause does not insulate state legislatures from the ordinary exercise of state judicial review, Roberts wrote for the Moore majority, and he quoted the court's 2015 decision in Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, in which the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg noted, quote, "Nothing in the Elections Clause instructs, nor has this court ever held, that a state legislature may prescribe regulations on the time, place, and manner of holding federal elections in defiance of provisions of the state's constitution," unquote. So in Moore, Roberts wrote for the majority, quote, "Although we conclude that the Elections Clause does not exempt state legislatures from the ordinary constraints imposed by state law, state courts do not have free rein," unquote. And Roberts added on behalf of the majority that federal courts still retain the authority to review decisions of state courts to ensure that they don't violate federal law. Now, while rejecting the independent state legislature doctrine and affirming the power of state and federal courts to review decisions of state legislatures, the majority in Moore did not prescribe a standard of review. Roberts wrote, quote, "We hold only that state courts may not transgress the ordinary bounds of judicial review such that they arrogate to themselves the power vested in state legislatures to regulate federal elections." And Roberts finally wrote, "State courts retain the authority to apply state constitutional restraints when legislatures act under the power conferred upon them by the Elections Clause," unquote.
Who were the other five members of the court who signed the majority opinion?
They were, you might imagine, the three liberals on the court, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. But Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett also joined John Roberts and the three liberals in voting to reject the independent state legislature doctrine.
Now, Marjorie, what did the dissent say?
Clarence Thomas wrote the dissent on behalf of himself, Neil Gorsuch, and Samuel Alito. And he wrote that the court should not even have reviewed the Moore case because it was moot, because of the North Carolina Supreme Court had already decided the issue. Thomas and Gorsuch would have applied the independent state legislature doctrine, but it fortunately was not adopted by the majority of the court.
Now, Marjorie, can you please explain Roberts' track record in voting rights cases?
Yes, in 2013, Roberts authored the opinion in Shelby County versus Holder, which was a ruling that gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It had required federal preclearance before changes to election rules in jurisdictions with a history of discriminatory voting practices. But in that Holder decision, Roberts provided assurances that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act would still be available to protect voting rights. But in 2021, Roberts and Kavanaugh voted with the majority in Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee to weaken Section 2, which basically prevents discrimination in voting. The six right-wingers on the court in the Brnovich case upheld two voting restrictions that made it harder for people of color to vote. And then just recently in the current term of the Supreme Court, in a 4-5 opinion, which was written by Roberts and joined by Kavanaugh, the majority held that Alabama's congressional map likely violates the Voting Rights Act's prohibition against discriminatory voting practices in Section 2.
Marjorie, can you tell us what happened in Allen v. Milligan?
Yes, the court refused Alabama's request to interpret the Voting Rights Act in a manner that would have made it much more difficult to challenge racist redistricting plans. At issue in Milligan was a GOP-drawn redistricting map to be used in voting for seven seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Despite the fact that black people comprised 27% of Alabama's population, the map included only one black majority district out of seven districts. Alabama's map packed large numbers of black voters into one congressional district in the so-called Black Belt and dispersed the remaining black population throughout other districts so that black voters had almost no chance of electing a second representative. So the map diluted the political power of the state's black residents. The five-member majority found that Alabama's map probably violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which, as I said, bars voting practices that deny or abridge the right to vote on account of race. And the court rejected Alabama's argument that maps should be drawn in a, quote, race-neutral manner, unquote. What does that remind you of, affirmative action? The Supreme Court in Allen versus Milligan adopted the lower court's findings that, quote, elections in Alabama were racially polarized and that black Alabamians enjoy virtually zero success in statewide elections, and that Alabama's extensive history of repugnant racial and voting-related discrimination is undeniable and well-documented. But, and here's the but, Roberts reserved the possibility of weakening the Voting Rights Act in a future case, writing that this decision does not diminish or disregard the concerns of the right-wing members of the court that Section 2, quote, may impermissibly elevate race in the allocation of political power within the states, unquote. Now, bottom line, in the wake of the Milligan decision, the nonpartisan Cook Political Report projected that five states would shift to Democrats in the House of Representatives, which is the number required for them to regain the majority. So you see, it's a very consequential decision.
So, Marjorie, the question remains, why do you think Roberts decided to uphold voting rights in Milligan and Moore?
Well, whether Roberts had a change of heart about protecting voting rights after his decisions in Shelby versus Holder and Brnovich, or whether he simply sought to legitimize a beleaguered Supreme Court widely viewed as partisan and unethical, or whether he aimed to neutralize his gutting of affirmative action and student loan forgiveness, he did the right thing in Moore. What the high court resolved in Moore was not radical. It maintained the status quo, which had been the law for more than two centuries, that state courts could review legislative enactments affecting voting rights.
So what's going to happen now in North Carolina after Moore?
Moore will have no practical effect on the North Carolina voting map at issue in this case, since the state Supreme Court authorized, this is the new GOP, controlled state Supreme Court in North Carolina, authorized the GOP-controlled legislature to draw gerrymandered maps as it wished, and the U.S. Supreme Court did not disturb that ruling. That's because this happened so quickly that it was not fully briefed or raised, so they just rejected the independent state legislature doctrine but did not actually disturb the ruling of the now GOP-controlled North Carolina Supreme Court. What this now means is the North Carolina Supreme Court's overruling of its prior decision allows Republican lawmakers in the state to again move forward with the crafting of a GOP-favorable map. North Carolina's 14-seat House delegation is currently split evenly, though conservatives in Raleigh could conceivably draw a map that wins them 11 seats.
And what immediate implications could Moore v. Harper have in other states?
It could have immediate implications in key battleground states such as Wisconsin, whose voters just elected a liberal majority to its Supreme Court that could strike down Wisconsin's gerrymandered congressional map under the state constitution. The website Democracy Docket reports that there are 28 active state court cases challenging congressional maps and state laws that regulate federal elections. Seven of the cases involve state constitutional challenges to congressional maps, nearly all of which raise claims of partisan gerrymandering. The other 21 lawsuits challenge voter suppression and election subversion laws. They will not now have the threat of the independent state legislature doctrine hanging over them.
Could a future Supreme Court overrule state court decisions that uphold the results of free and fair elections?
Well, theoretically, yes. The Supreme Court preserved the role of federal courts in state court decisions that impact federal election laws, and in so doing, they left the door open for the U.S. Supreme Court to overrule state court decisions that uphold the results of free and fair elections. Hopefully that will not happen. We have an extreme right-wing majority on the Supreme Court, a supermajority of the conservatives who haven't done that yet, but it is conceivable that it could happen in the future.
Marjorie, in our few remaining minutes, what is the only way to truly protect voting rights?
Well, Heidi, it's incumbent upon Congress to pass meaningful voting reform. Since the 2020 election chaos, the Senate's filibuster rule, right-wing obstructionist Democrats, and Republicans who reclaim control of the House of Representatives have obstructed the passage of national voting rights legislation as Republican state legislators continue their voter suppression efforts across the country. And no matter what the courts do in this case-by-case development here, the bottom line is that Congress has to pass real, meaningful voting rights legislation, and that is just not in the cards in the near term, I'm afraid.
Marjorie, once again, thank you so much for your in-depth analysis, this time on an important voting rights case.
Great to be with you, Heidi.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
There was the Stop the Roof Depot demolition, where the indigenous dominant neighborhood of East Phillips occupied a site that was supposed to be demolished by the city. They stopped the demolition, which would have put more toxins into the atmosphere, and they're trying to reclaim that site for not only the indigenous people who live in that community, but also for the non-indigenous people, to reclaim it as a site for farming, sustainable farming, agriculture, and sort of local businesses. There's also still the ongoing efforts to reclaim the Black Hills, and I think we're going to see some more action around that in the coming years. It's an outstanding land claim, and it's not going away anytime soon.
That's Nick Estes, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Nick Estes, Wounded Knee to Standing Rock, Indigenous Resistance. In South Dakota in 1973, hundreds of Native American activists, led by members of the American Indian Movement, occupied the Pine Ridge Reservation village of Wounded Knee, which was also the site of a notorious massacre in 1890 in which federal troops killed 300 Lakota men, women, and children. The months-long action in 1973 helped galvanize the movement for indigenous rights, which continues today. As the great historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz says, U.S. policies involving indigenous peoples have consistently been designed to disadvantage the indigenous, locking them into suppressed social status and codifying dependence on the U.S. government. Despite a history of oppression and genocide and continued discrimination, Native Americans are organizing and resisting. A younger generation of indigenous activists offers the promise of not just survival, but for a resurgence of indigenous societies and a renaissance of traditional culture. To talk about indigenous resistance is Nick Estes. He's a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. He's professor in the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. He's co-founder of the Red Nation. His articles appear in The Intercept, Jacobin, and Indian Country Today. He's the author of Our History is the Future and co-author of Standing with Standing Rock. I talked with Nick Estes in early May at the University of Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me again, David.
Well, it's the 50th anniversary of a historic event in Native America, the action at Wounded Knee. Talk about its significance, and does it resonate today at all with Native peoples?
Absolutely. In fact, this last February 27th, there was a 50th anniversary commemoration in which there was 3 days of powwows, dance competitions. There was an oral history project through the Warrior Women Project, documenting and really highlighting and foregrounding